And good afternoon, brothers and sisters. It's indeed a pleasure to be here and to partake in the spiritual blessings as well as the enjoyments that we have while we're here and being able to meet people of like precious faith and spend time with them and meet new people. It's a good time and I'm really enjoying it. The chapter I have to deal with is a short chapter, so my talk probably will be a little shorter than some of the others and probably miss out quite a few things, so I'm going to be expecting that the brethren will be able to pick up and fill in where I've missed out. I'd like to mention those that have gone before. They've all done a really good job, and especially Brother Lenny, I think, really laid a good foundation for us and kind of setting the stage for this study. It's a study that I'm enjoying. It's not something of a technical nature. I tried to see if there were any spiritual significances, but in a way they're all spiritual, but as far as types and so forth, and I wasn't able to find anything, and I'm not saying there aren't, but I would say this, that the literal words here are absolutely profound, because they're dealing with the issues of life. And what could be more profound than that? So I think they're really important, and also I think they're also a very, very, it's a very spiritual study. This chapter then follows the theme that we've become familiar with in the study of Ecclesiastes, in that it emphasizes the vanity of this life when considered outside God's purpose with mankind. So we're talking about, you know, the 70 years versus possibility of eternity. The preacher, Solomon, has had opportunity to try all kinds of things that many of us might desire to do, but we just don't have the resources at our disposal that he had, and he actually was able to do a lot of the things that we only dream about. And because God endowed Solomon with wisdom, he was able to see the end result of all kinds of things, which most of us don't really get to see. We get a little bit, and then we're out of resources and out of time. So Solomon was able to do some of the mighty works and the things that were absolutely desirable, and impressed, in fact, the nations around him with the works that he did. So he certainly did excel in what he did. I think it's important to recognize that Solomon was not saying that we should be so overwhelmed with the vanity of this life that we might as well give up. You should never bother putting out any effort to try anything or, go for anything. But what he is saying is that we must see it for what it really is: temporary and for the present only. The benefit is only for the present. It is useful and necessary. We have to have food and raiment, but we should be there with content. Verses 1 and 2, and I've kind of grouped these together as I thought the subject matter in them hopefully fits together. Verses 1 and 2 says, "There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men, A man to whom God hath given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all that he desireth, yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eateth it. This is vanity and an evil disease. What I think these verses are saying is that he's pointing out the inequity of a person who faithfully and with great effort builds a nest egg and then becomes sick and dies prematurely, perhaps, so that he does not have the opportunity to enjoy of the fruits of his labor. And then the inheritance, to add insult to injury, the inheritance passes to someone unknown to him, or someone who doesn't even know him, doesn't even really know where this came from. This is indeed an evil. Verses 3 through 5 I put together. If a man beget 100 children and live many years, so that the days of his years be many and his soul be not filled with good, and also that he have no burial, I say that an untimely birth is better than he. For he cometh in with vanity and departeth in darkness, and his name shall be covered with darkness. Moreover, he hath not seen the sun nor known anything. This hath more rest than the other. And this here, again, this is my effort at putting it into our words or deciphering the meaning. It differs only a little from the first example, except in this case he is not blessed with comforts as the one man or person in verse 1 and 2. He works hard, has many children, lives a long time, but ends up not being cared for or about. And also then he compares that with a child who is born but dies, I think, immediately at birth. And he's saying, really, that child is better off than one who goes through all this sorrow and travail and then passes away and is not appreciated. This also is an evil end, not to be desired. This Bible indicates that verse 6 is a new thought, but I really don't think it is, and I've opted to say that it really should have been included with verses 3, 4, and 5. And perhaps it's just to emphasize the point that it's put this way. It is unlikely that anyone would have 100 children unless it is referring to children or grandchildren and great-grandchildren, which it may well be, as the Scriptures quite often does. And we know it is not possible that one should live 1,000 years, let alone 2,000. So I believe this is the language of hyperbole, and I hope that's the right term. But giving an extreme example to emphasize the point. Verses 7 and 8 I put together. All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. For what hath the wise more than the fool? What hath the poor that knoweth to walk before the living? These verses, in fact, prove to be very true. It is a fact that in most cases we tend to spend what we earn, and I think, as Brother Glendon mentioned that already, whether we earn little or much. In most cases, our appetite, not just for food and drink, by the way, gobble up what we think we have available to spend. And again, in most cases, we are still not completely satisfied with what we have at the moment. In this way, the thought of verse 8 proves true, that whether we are in the class of the fool or the wise, the poor or the rich, all tends to balance out and cancel out in the end, because we can only consume so much of anything. The rest is really just window dressing. verse 9 and 10. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. That which hath been is named already, and it is known that it is man. Neither may he contend with him that is mightier than he. Here Solomon, I believe, states what we have all experienced. Whether our desire has been a simple thing, such as, you know, our favorite kind of food, or greater possessions, such as a beautiful property, home, vehicle, or whatever, we wish and wish for whatever it is until the moment when we gain possession of that envied object, you know, get the keys. And then we feel great satisfaction and pride and enjoyment in it. But if we are never able to decide or settle on what we want in the first place, we are in a constant state of longing and wishing. And we know that there's no fulfillment to that. The verse 10 I found to be a little more difficult to understand, and I've made an attempt at it. Maybe we can have some discussion around it. It seems to me that the first part of the sentence should be separated from the part which follows the comma. In other words, that which hath been is named already. It's kind of a statement by itself. It should be perhaps a period. The first phrase seems to say that there really is nothing new that has not been named already by someone, even though the name they use might be quite different than the name that we would use, and therefore we don't recognize it. The rest of the sentence might be included with the remainder of the verse, which may be saying that man does indeed know what we are like. And as Jesus said, or as was said of Jesus, he needed not that any should tell him what was in man. And therefore, we cannot contend with one who is mightier, and I believe it's a reference to Yahweh himself. Verses 11 and 12. Seeing there be many things that increase vanity, what is man the better? For who knoweth what is good for man in this life, all the days of his vain life, which he spendeth as a shadow? For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? This, it would seem, is an ode to the vanity of life. And it is asking why we would desire to add to the vanity that is already there, and in which we all share, more or less, equally, regardless of our position. Solomon almost seems to throw his hands up in a lament as to the futility of life. But I think we should not take it that the question has no good answers, because I think he proceeds to answer the question in part in the first few verses of chapter 7, which we'll hear about tomorrow. I don't believe even that is the final answer. You know, is that your final answer? I don't think so, because I believe that the ultimate conclusion and answer is posed at the end of the book, which we shall see. I wanted to end up with a personal anecdote, which I think sums it up all very well. And I'm sure that you all probably know of situations like this. This is just my own. It's a true story, and some of you may even recognize the character involved. But I think it's a very present-day demonstration of what Solomon was talking about. There was a man who was a very close neighbor to us when I was a boy, and he had built up a very nice farm for his day and age. He owned about double the amount of land that an average farm for that day would have been. He had also built up a herd of purebred cattle that were indeed his pride and joy. He built up a beautiful yard surrounded by hand-planted trees, which was quite a luxury for us on the prairies, if any of you have ever been there. He had also built a log house, which was far better than many for that day, and a hip roof barn, with many outbuildings, including a good well, complete with a windmill. And again, that's another luxury which you're probably familiar with in this part of the world. He was known and respected in the community as a good neighbor to one and all. As he grew older, he could no longer farm the land or tend to the horses and cattle by himself, and so eventually was forced to move to an old folks' home in the city. His homestead fell into disrepair and lay abandoned for many years. He eventually fell asleep in death a few years later. His land was sold to neighbors and changed hands a few times until it finally ended up being purchased by the Canadian government as part of a treaty entitlement program to give to the Aboriginal peoples for shortfalls in past programs. As part of that deal, all buildings and fixtures had to be destroyed by burning or removal. And as it happens, I have ended up farming that same land. This spring, while working the field, I took a few minutes and walked into the yard site to have a look and a moment of reflection. The buildings are all gone. The well is stopped. And there are no traces of what was once there, except for the trees that were planted. If I had not known where things used to be, there would have been no clue as to what had been. The neighbors have mostly changed, so that today, if one spoke of this man, many of the neighbors would have no idea of who you were talking about. His relatives have moved on and probably hardly remember him. He had no wife or children. All that remains is a gravestone and a few notes in a history book. Now, this is not a special case or an isolated one. I'm sure that we all know of people who we have known and have disappeared almost without a trace. But this is my personal reminder of the vanity of this life. There is, however, one huge difference in this particular case. This man had become a baptized believer of the gospel. He had faithfully supported my grandfather in a young and sometimes difficult ecclesia. While we don't know what the end result for him will be, we do look forward with some confidence to the return of our Lord Jesus and to our reuniting with him then. While hardly anything remains physically of him and his works, I cannot sum it up any more appropriately than to quote from one of the hymns that we sing. Those characters shall firm remain, our everlasting trust, when gems and monuments and crowns have moldered into dust.
Thank you, Brother Gordon, for those opening remarks. This will open the class for discussion. Any comments or questions? Brother David?
Just to kind of go along with the story that Brother Gordon told us, in, you know, verse 2 there, it talks about God giving somebody riches and wealth and honor, and then not being able to enjoy it. You know, I worked for my dad in the summer times delivering home care equipment to the sick. And, you know, you go into these big houses and you know, they're too sick. They can't even walk across the room without getting out of breath. And they're not able to enjoy it. And, you know, I think that's a message that the that's trying to be brought out here in the Ecclesiastes is to enjoy each day. And that doesn't mean that you forget about God. A lot of times as Christadelphians we say, no, we're to serve God, and that's true. We are. Our enjoyment is going to be in the future at Christ's return. But we're also to give thanks for each day that God has given us. And in almost every chapter, there is a verse that he's telling us to be satisfied with what you have. Give thanks for your portion that you have. You don't have to be the richest person. You don't have to have the most children. You have to be content with what you have, and you have to give thanks to God for what you have. You know, we know Israel was not content in the wilderness, and they complained about the manna and wanted the leeks that was in Egypt. And are we any different? Do we give thanks for the food, and then we go in there and say, "Oh, we're having whatever it is again"? You know, can't you make something different? Are we any different than Israel? And you know, it's so clear to us that we could say, "How could Israel stand up and complain about what God's given us?" Yet are we different? Do we complain, or do we enjoy each day? And you know, that doesn't mean that we go out and do whatever we want, but we have to remember that God has given us gifts, and we are to use them to serve God, but also to gain pleasure. You know, we work hard, and we should enjoy it. We're not to be miserable.
Brother Aaron?
First, I'd like to thank our Brother Gordon for his opening remarks. Solomon uses some very strong language when he says, "I say that an untimely birth is better than he." An untimely birth is a miscarriage. It's better to, you know, not even be born, or if you're going to be born, to die right away, than to live 100 years old or 1,000, 2,000 years old and not have any goodness, not have any righteousness. If you're going to live forever, what good is it if you just sin all the time? It's worthless without any sort of goodness, any sort of righteousness.
Brother Sid?
John?
Thank Brother Gordon for his comments and others as well. I'm just going to go back to thinking about a comment Brother Jim Somerville made a day or two ago about the old and foolish king, and he suggested that the identity of that old and foolish king was Solomon himself, and he was looking forward to the day when his servant Jeroboam would take over, and his own son, obviously he could see, did not have the character that was necessary to stay in leadership of the whole nation. And it seems to me like this verse 2 is a continuation of that scenario. Solomon had all kinds of riches and wealth and honor, so that he wanted nothing for his soul of all that he desired. Yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof, and a stranger eateth it. He could see the day coming when he would not be there to continue with the enjoyment of what he had built up, and he could see Jeroboam about to rise and enjoy that. Now he may have been prevented from eating of it or enjoying it by death or by the decline of his health, as Brother David has brought to our attention. However, he may simply have been deprived of the enjoyment of it because of the things that he learned. I mean, he's been telling us all the way through. He's enjoyed all this opulence, and he keeps coming back to the same thing. It's all vanity and vexation of spirit. And so all of this that he built up for his enjoyment, he realized that was not going to continue to keep giving him the level of enjoyment that he had once expected.
Brother Burrell?
It's already been said at least once, if not a couple of times, already this week, but Solomon keeps bringing it up, and therefore I'm going to reiterate what has already been said in the very end of the chapter under discussion. You know, he brings out, who knoweth what is good for a man in this life? But we don't know what the future brings for us personally. I can't tell you what's going to happen tomorrow, and I don't think anybody else can. We do have a bit of knowledge of the future. I mean, we can virtually state without being wrong that we're going to die, we're going to go to judgment, and we're going to be raised, we're going to be judged, and Christ is going to set up a kingdom upon the earth. That's going to happen. So it's not like we don't know what's going to happen, but nobody here can say when it's going to happen. Nobody can say when they're going to die. Nobody can say when the kingdom's going to be set up. It's something we want to happen. It's something we're longing for, but nobody knows. You know, we don't know in an instant what's going to happen. I think it was Brother Jim said that you can put money in the stock market and you don't know whether it's going to go up or down. You can make a guess, but you don't honestly know. If we did, we're all greedy people. We'd probably be multimillionaires if we could judge what's going to happen tomorrow. But God knows. I mean, there is no question that He knows exactly what's going to happen tomorrow. The very hairs in your head are numbered. He knows the day you're going to die. He knows the day Christ is going to return. It's His plan and His purpose. So our lives are spent as a shadow. But God is light and dwelleth in light and knoweth all things. And He knoweth the things that we don't know. We can take comfort in those facts. We can take comfort in the idea that although we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring for us, we can take comfort in the fact that God knows and God has prepared events for those that love Him. And those events are the fact we're going to die, we're going to be judged, and Christ is going to reign upon the earth. Those facts are prepared to keep us happy, keep us smiling in the face of adversity. No matter what happens, we know those events are going to happen. Even though we don't know when, we do know it. And that should leave a song in your heart at all times, because no matter what things are going wrong or things are going right, you know, as one time one brother put it, there's a good time coming.
Brother Ben?
I'd like to add my thanks to Brother Gordon for his opening remarks. We had there in verse 1, there's an evil which I have seen under the sun and is common among men. We've had a few comments on verse 2 there. A man to whom God hath given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all that he desireth, yet God giveth him not the power to eat thereof. And as Brother Gordon said, almost to add insult to injury, but a stranger eateth it. This is vanity and it is an evil disease. And then also sort of in that seventh verse, all the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled. Just sort of to offer the beautiful contrast to that, we have in Isaiah chapter 65, I'm sure we're all familiar with, "Behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered." The former being those things that we're talking about in Ecclesiastes. "The former shall not be remembered, nor come into mind." If we skip down, it says, "They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and shall eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit, and they shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble. For they are the seed of the blessed of Yahweh, and their offspring with them." So in Isaiah chapter 65, we have presented to us the contrast. What we're reading in Ecclesiastes is the trouble and toil that we go through, and it was particularly that second verse where it says that the stranger was going to take from the man that had wealth, and even though he had provided for himself, he was not going to be able to partake of it. We have hope of that future day when they shall not build and another inhabit. They shall benefit from the own works from their works of their own hands. And that's something that we, as Brother Burl was just talking about, that's something that we can keep, that's one of those things that we can keep in mind, the comfort of the coming age.
Brother Dean?
Brothers and sisters, I'd like to thank Brother Gordon, especially for his story at the end. I knew who he was talking about, but as a very, very young person, so I really didn't know him, perhaps like Brother Gord did. But the question remains in the story that he told. Even though all his possessions are gone, and as Brother Gordon pointed out, he does have that hope that we all look forward to. And we can see that here in Ecclesiastes in what Gordon just went through. And in verse 8, says he asked a question, "For what more has the wise man than the fool?" And it's interesting because we had just talked about that a couple days ago, I think on the first day of High here, in chapter 2 and verse 13. And he answers that very question. He said, "Then I saw that wisdom excels folly, as light excels darkness." So what the brother that Brother Gordon was mentioning is that he didn't put his stock and faith and trust in all the things that he possessed. He had that wisdom to put his faith and his trust in Yahweh to wait for him as he sleeps. And I thought it was quite interesting that when I started looking at that, I started flipping through the chapters that we've been considering, and quite often we see the word sun and the word darkness mentioned, and I really never noticed it before until just today. And it reminded me then back, takes us right back to Genesis, the third verse in the Bible. Actually, even before that, verse 2, he says, "The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep." It's really interesting how God describes the world. It is without form and it is without void. And that is the way it is today. When we look at the world around us, it was referred to as Egypt. It's been referred to as Babylon. And it's referred to in Ecclesiastes. We can see the world around us is without form and void. So what this brother basically had was the light, the spirit light, the truth, and did not put his trust and faith in those things which are of no form and those things which are void. I just thought it was a neat connection between the creation and what we're studying here today.
Brother Nairn?
While I was listening to Brother Ben's comments, I was reminded, in verse 7 it says, "All the labor of man is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not filled." And I'm reminded of the words of the Messiah, and it says here in John chapter 6, "And Jesus said unto them, I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger, and he that believeth on me shall never thirst." So if we keep on seeking material goods, material wealth, we'll never be satisfied. But if we approach Yeshua, our Messiah, we yearn after the Word, we labor after Him and our Father, then we shall never be hungry. We should always be full.
Brother Pat?
Well, Aaron, I'm glad you brought that up before. I forgot what the thought was myself about seeking material wealth. I'm thinking of Abraham in Scripture, who was a rich man, but he used all of his things in the right way. But I was also thinking of someone we're all familiar with. We've used him in exhortations quite a bit about the ones who were in the wilderness, Joshua and Caleb. The ones that you might ask a question like, what's it say in the Scripture about them? Where do they spend their time? Usually by the tabernacle and other places. It seems like you see that in Scripture. But did their line continue that way? According to 1 Samuel 25, when David is fleeing from Saul, he comes across a relative of Caleb. I can imagine we all pretty well know who that was. Nabal. Nabal was related to Caleb. And when David takes care of things, Nabal says, should I, with my stuff, take care of someone who's running away from their master and everything? And they... David's about ready to kill him. It's Abigail who saves the day with that one. But the idea was that here Nabal had all the riches, all the things he could give to help others. But it was all going into himself. He didn't know that David was ready to kill him and that Abigail had already brought some of the supplies to him. In an apology for Nabal's actions. Nabal, of course, means fool in Hebrew. So she doesn't say anything to Nabal that night. He waits when he's feasting. He's having a good time all by himself, it looks like. Then the next day she mentions it to him and he's dead just like that. And what happens to all the things which he worked for? He loses a wife by death, but who ends up really blessed, that has the right character, and there's no more you hear about him. And I was thinking of that as a kind of a contrast to what we've been saying of what we should not do, you know. I'm not saying about the idea of David taking Abigail away for a wife. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is whatever we come across, as Brother Robert said, if riches increase, you know, don't set your... Well, he didn't say it. That the Psalm said it. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them, Psalm 62. But Brother Robert said, if riches increase, then put them to use in God's service. And we've said that before, but it doesn't hurt to keep reminding ourselves, because we have this thing with our brains, it's called a sieve. You know, after a while we hear it one time, say, okay, I'll remember that, and then we go off and we forget what manner of men we are by what we should have seen. So anyway, I wanted to share that a little bit here. But I was very impressed with what Brother Gordon said about who it was that lived his life in wisdom, which is above all riches. It's above fine gold. It's above anything you could ever want. What can you give for in place of immortality? The idea that we can be made equal unto the angels and die no more, and to be sharing with one another like we are now in the kingdom.
Brother Lynn?
just sort of, you know, we know that Ecclesiastes is certainly a reflection on the life and experiences of Solomon. And certainly as we hear the story, you know, Brother Gordon relayed to us, and as we listen to the comments and read these chapters, those of us that have been on this earth a little bit more years than others certainly have more to reflect on in their experiences. But it's really to the young folks that I'm kind of making this comment to. The knowledge that can be gained out of Ecclesiastes is certainly so valuable at a young age, and it's difficult for you to appreciate it. And I can look back, and I'm sure many of the brethren can look back on their lives and realize if I had known that, if I believed that, certain decisions probably would have been made differently. You know, people in the world go their entire lives and don't ever come to the knowledge and understanding that all is vanity, and they can't take it with it. And those that do, what do they try to do? Especially those with lots of money. They try to create a legacy. Maybe they'll have a building named after them. Or maybe they'll have a trust fund named after them. You look at Bill Gates, you know, the Bill Gates Foundation and his wife. And, you know, yeah, they're giving away billions of dollars, but it's still... it's probably for personal pride and, you know, want to leave a legacy in their name. And, you know, you're bombarded with a lot of success stories. You know, the creator of Facebook or whoever did Google. These are young people. They've made millions of dollars. You know, we're seeing the airwaves of people in sport or entertainment. And yet, I can only imagine what goes through your mind. I mean, growing up outside the truth, I know what some of those thoughts were. So if you can grasp onto this, you know, we're halfway through the book at this point, make some notes out of what is being said by Solomon in the comments you hear. Try to put some of them to use to remember them, so when opportunities come up for you to make decisions, you know, keep in mind the vanity of these things and the value that you'll get out of it, you know, as we all know, in seeking after God and finding your way Zionward is immense, and you have a great opportunity to take advantage of it at a young age.
Brother Jim? You have a comment? Yeah, we'll have one more comment if you have one. Just sit on the edge of your chair. I'm thinking you're ready.
I can always make a comment. Brother Chairman, brethren and sisters, just we see in this chapter, as we have seen in just about every other chapter, a refrain that Solomon turns to. He's looking at the very pessimistic view of life. All is vanity and grasping at wind. And yet, he comes back time and time again that there's nothing better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy the good of his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. We shouldn't strive after riches. We've had that lesson over and over again in this book. But there's a opposite extreme that religious people can go to, and we see that in the monks. We see that in the ascetic societies, where they deprive themselves and suppose that they are more righteous because of self-deprivation. And reminds me of Isaiah. And he says, is this the fast that I have commanded, that a man should hang down his head like a bulrush? They go around lamenting on a fast day. It's a time to be sad. And it was. He says, is not rather this the fast that I have commanded? That you loose the prisoner and you help the fatherless and the poor? That's the kind of fast that God wanted. It's not, and Solomon's here saying, enjoy what God gave us. Don't live for it. Recognize it's from God. But we're not more righteous by being holding our head down like a bulrush and going around moping like, well, I've got to be sad. I can't enjoy it. There's that balance. And we should use it in a way that is helpful. and not outwardly showing. And just one last thought on the comment that Brother Gordon made, and that old brother. I met him just before he died. I had no idea his history until right now. Well, whether he's wealthy or not, he was a very old man. I believe he was in his 90s and near death. And I went to see him in the lodge, and he was very enthusiastic about the return of Christ and the hope of the resurrection of the dead. And that's all I saw in the man. I would not have had a clue of what Gordon spoke of today. And it's interesting to see a different perspective. I see this old man about to die, and his hope was in the return of Christ and the resurrection. So what he lost, apparently, he wasn't too concerned about.
Brother Pat, we need to close this for the last comment.
This is quick. This is quick, believe me. Jim brought up something about the enjoying it all but in the Lord. Brought to mind, says, when you fast, don't be of a sad countenance, but anoint your head with oil. Well, anyway, something on that idea. In other words, look normal and fast in secret, and God will reward you openly. Now, see, I mean, that didn't take long.
Not at all. Thank you. Brothers and sisters, obviously our heart is where our treasures are, and if our treasures are in heaven, nothing can corrupt that.